The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Present your case to our experts by calling in between 12:30 and 1 on Sundays. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now your host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Good afternoon. Steve Maskin here on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We are streaming live on www.focusonfemales.com. On that homepage, the left lower corner is a link. You left-click that button, and you get to our radio page where you can stream it live. The Radio Healthcare Clinic is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to saving lives and protecting families by making you a lay expert on your own individual medical problems. Now, the way the foundation does this is through two educational programs. One, the radio clinic that you hear here weekly, and the symposium that we have in March of each year. It's an annual symposium, and by all means, you should jot the date of the fourth annual Women's Healthcare Symposium down. It's March 21st, 2009, at the Tampa Convention Center, and there with it is a free event, a free symposium, and we have over 20 different medical topics with physician experts discussing in plain English about how to manage these problems that you have with your health. Together with these educational programs, it will enable you to better partner with your existing doctors for more effective office visits and fast results, and really, very importantly, to reduce the economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. The program topics for the upcoming several weeks, just quickly reviewing them: bladder incontinence, multiple sclerosis, fibromyalgia, hypertension, shingles, TMJ dysfunction, and sleep disorders, a wide variety, and that just takes us into mid-December. Again, you can find those topics and the dates and the physician experts discussing these topics on the website. Now, I want to remind you all that listening is great, but calling in is even better. There's no such thing as anything less than a good question. All questions are good questions, and others are no doubt thinking the same thing. So by all means, call in and ask your question. Now, last week we had nutrition as our topic, and just to repeat one message from that show: the more colorful your plate is, the better it is for you nutrition-wise. Fruits and vegetables, the more color, the better. For today's healthcare clinic program, we have the good fortune to have Dr. Dennis Ledford with us. Dr. Ledford received his medical degree from the University of Tennessee Center for Health Sciences. He remained in Memphis for the completion of his internal medicine residency and served as chief medical resident at the City of Memphis Hospital. A fellowship in rheumatology and immunology followed at New York University and Bellevue Hospital in New York City. This was followed by a fellowship in allergy and immunology at the University of South Florida, where he completed his training. Dr. Ledford then joined the faculty of the University of South Florida in Tampa, achieving the rank of Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics in 2000. He is currently chief of the Allergy and Immunology Section of the University Community Hospital and a medical staff member of Tampa General Hospital, Moffitt Cancer Center, and the James A. Haley VA Hospital. Dennis, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And by means of introduction to the topic of allergies, let me ask you to define an allergy for the average layperson's understanding.
Allergy means a bad outcome from an immune response. So your immune system protects you from infection, from cancer, from a variety of problems in the world. But when there's an immune response with a bad outcome, that's an allergy.
How would you compare an allergy versus a sensitivity versus, say, a toxicity from a medication?
It's a great question because these things often overlap. But a sensitivity would be more of an intolerance for a variety of reasons, which could include allergy, but could also include other mechanisms. For example, I am very fair. I don't tan very well. I could say I'm sun sensitive, but there's no immune response involved. A toxicity is where a substance is inherently toxic to the body and causes problems, again, without an immune response necessary. An example there might be some type of pollutant or chemical that would have an adverse health outcome without an immune response.
Excellent. And obviously all these different entities, sensitivities, toxicities, and allergies, would be each treated in completely different ways.
Exactly. Very different. But, of course, from the observation of the person who's affected or the family member who's affected, what the individual sees is something happens, an event, an ingestion, an exposure, and then a symptom occurs. And so the word allergy is often used if that whatever happened was not desirable.
Now, as an aside, you talked about observations, and obviously family members oftentimes can make observations about the patient that the patient may not be aware of his or herself. So do you recommend when a patient who may have an allergy, sensitivity, or toxicity, when that patient goes in to see their physician, do you recommend that family members attend?
Yes, I think more information is valuable in making an assessment, but sometimes a lot of psychological anxiety issues kind of get involved too, so you have to be careful about too much information, but a valid observation of symptoms that occur after things that happen is very useful. It's also important to remember too, though, that just because B follows A does not mean that A caused B, and sometimes that's a bit confusing too to people who are looking for an explanation to their symptoms.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, let's say someone eats a food that they may have had a problem with, and then they develop a symptom. They might conclude then that the food caused the symptom. For example, they could be lactose. This is a good example of a condition which is often confused with allergy. Lactase deficiency is the enzyme that breaks down lactose and milk sugar. So if you're lactase deficient and you drink milk, you develop bloating, diarrhea, gas, a lot of symptoms that you might say, well, I'm allergic to milk. Well, it is not an allergy. It's an enzyme deficiency where you don't tolerate the food. It's a sensitivity. So, again, the observation might be I had symptoms after drinking milk, therefore my headache is due to milk because my headache occurred after I drank the milk. But lactase deficiency doesn't usually cause headache. So, again, right, there might be a misinterpretation of the symptoms.
Okay. Now, Dennis, tell me, are we all born with allergies? And if we do, do they ever go away?
That was a great point you made about the family observing things, because often the affected individual doesn't recognize it. And I think allergy does sometimes fall into that area, because people are born genetically allergic. That is, they're born prone to becoming allergic to the common allergens in our environment, food, inhalants such as dust and pollen and mold. Those type of allergies, we're born with a tendency. But the symptoms develop over time. The genetic tendency is there, but it doesn't manifest itself until sufficient exposure occurs. So the infant doesn't have symptoms immediately upon exposure, but over the passage of time, you'll see these symptoms begin to develop. And typically, the first thing that occurs is food sensitivity in an infant, often with eczema, which is a rash associated with allergy. And then later, they'll have other features such as asthma or hay fever. Now, that should not be confused with things such as insect allergy, which in that case is not as much linked to genetics, and therefore that can develop pretty much at any point. So again, although it's genetic and we're born with it, it sort of evolves over time and changes. So some people feel like they outgrow their allergy, and indeed they seem to improve as the years pass, whereas others seem to grow into their allergy.
Well, that's fascinating. Is there any way that genetic studies can be done to predict one's tendencies toward developing allergies, whether it be early in life or later in life?
That's a hot topic of research, and a great deal of effort has been expended in trying to identify the allergy gene. But as for many chronic diseases we face, whether it be hypertension or diabetes, these seem to be polygenic, meaning multiple genes are involved, and therefore it's very difficult to do a test and then make a pronouncement whether you are or you're not going to be allergic. So probably the best way we have today of telling whether you're going to become allergic as a child, for example, is your family history. So although the technology of genetic analysis is attractive in making this determination, right now our best friend is a good family history, because the more family members affected by allergy, the more likely the individual is to be allergic.
And let's say you have a number of your family members with an allergy to a specific stimulus. Can the allergic responses vary within that family?
Absolutely. And I think you'll see this in family units, where often the parent had one experience, the oldest sibling or child had one experience, and then another child has a different. So that's another mystery, why someone would develop sensitivity to food when they're an infant, yet their brother or sister may not have that at all, but yet become cat allergic when they're eight. So it's highly variable, and because the mother or father is allergic to a given substance does not mean that the child will become allergic to that substance necessarily. It's just that they have the tendency to develop allergy.
For example, milk create different symptoms in twins of the same family? For example, one child maybe present with diarrhea and the other one present with eczema, the same milk stimulus.
I don't know if you were referring to fraternal twins or identical twins. I think it would be more likely with fraternal twins that you would see variability. With identical twins, most likely they're going to show very similar symptoms of an allergic response. But again, keep in mind the complexity of these is difficult. For example, if you've had a viral infection, you lose the enzyme lactase, and so you'll become temporarily lactose intolerant. So that child might be having problems with milk, even though there's an allergic background, and yet it isn't really due to an allergy. So again, it confuses the observation made by a very observant family member that there is an allergy responsible for the given symptoms. But with identical twins, I would expect the symptoms to be very, very similar.
Okay. We have a caller, Karen. You are on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic with Steve Maskin. Do you have a question on allergies for Dr. Dennis Ledford?
Yes, I do. My question, Dr. Ledford, is I have four children, and my oldest child has a milk allergy. Now, he was diagnosed with that about a year ago. My first question is, will he grow out of that, and when should he be retested for that?
Well, thank you, Karen. How old is your oldest child?
Six years old.
And he was just recently diagnosed with a milk allergy?
Right, about a year ago.
And what were the symptoms? Was it gastrointestinal or beyond that?
I think it was mainly the congestion, nasal congestion and sneezing and very, just not feeling really well. He also has other allergies, pollen and dust mites and all those others, too.
Well, it's a very good question, because it's a common one that we see. Of the food allergens we encounter, egg and milk are the most common. Cow's milk and chicken egg are the most common sensitivities. And for the most part, children outgrow those allergies. They, as they get older, their intestinal tract either matures or somehow their bodies become more tolerant, and it gets to where they can eat those foods. And typically, as they're older children or teenage or adults, they can eat the foods without any concerns whatsoever. It's a little unusual for a child to be diagnosed with milk allergy at 5 or 6. Usually they're going to be a few months of age up to a couple of years in age. And one of the problems can be that they may show, an individual, your child, may show sensitivity on testing to milk, mm-hmm. and the milk may not be causing the symptoms, because you alluded to the fact that your child is allergic to other things as well. Mm-hmm. And those allergens, they're not likely to outgrow. So that once you become allergic to, say, a cat or dust mite right. or pollen, that doesn't tend to go away as you get older, typically. Unless you're a lot older, you know, over the age of 30 or 40, maybe then it might get better, but not as an 8-year-old or 10-year-old. So I would say in general that your child's milk problem will improve as they get older, and I would expect it to be very soon. And I would even raise a question of, is the milk really responsible for the symptoms? Because milk is a very important food for children. It's our only really good source of calcium.
Well, I do know that he's allergic to the incasin.
The casein. Yes, casein is a protein in milk, mm-hmm. and that's most all allergies are to proteins or glycoproteins, which are proteins with a little bit of sugar stuck on them.
So you're saying, Dennis, that this is maybe more of a true allergy than a sensitivity?
Yeah, from what she's saying to me, if it's casein allergy by testing, and it's then proven by observation that when milk is ingested, symptoms occur, congestion or sneezing, as was alluded to, that would be a true allergy. That's not a lactase deficiency. I was just pointing out, though, that often kids who are allergic to milk are also allergic to other allergens. So now the question is, well, maybe the symptoms aren't due to the milk at all. It was just an additional thing found when testing was done. And I hate to say, don't drink any milk, you're allergic to milk, and deny your child access to calcium and vitamin D that's so important to growth.
Well, Karen, does your child take other forms of milk?
Yes, he drinks soy milk.
And there's no symptoms?
No symptoms.
And that would be expected, because soy is another allergen. It's certainly not infrequent, but not as common as chicken, egg, and cow's milk. But it does not cross-react with cow's milk, so one would expect that a child with milk allergy could drink soy. But I'm just suggesting that sometimes there's value in challenging a child with milk to verify that the test that was done really proves allergy. Tests do not prove allergy. They prove that your immune system reacts to the food, but it doesn't prove it's causing your symptoms, unless you clearly correlate the ingestion with the symptoms.
Okay. So you'd recommend challenging this young man with cow's milk and see how he does? Or would you recommend patch testing or other type of testing?
No, there's no other test. I think she's already knows that he's sensitive to casein. The question is now, are we sure that the casein is what's causing his symptoms?
So will he always be sensitive to that casein then?
As a rule, no. Milk and egg, you tend to outgrow as you get older. But as I said, usually it's diagnosed when you're 6 months or a year or two of age, not when you're 5 or 6, as her child is.
But you're saying there's no benefit, there's no reason right now to be re-challenged for casein, just to go ahead and give him the challenge of the cow's milk and see how he does?
Well, assuming the symptoms are not life-threatening as she described them, I think it would be reasonable to do what we call this is an outpatient challenge. We usually have you come to our office and you ingest the food under observation by medical staff who can document the symptoms as well as make sure if there's any adverse event it can be treated. But if the reaction was fairly mild and not life-threatening, that could be done at home if the parents were comfortable with that process.
Okay.
My other question is...
Karen, we're going to have to take a break. Sorry, I'm going to take a break now, and when we come right back, we'll go right to your question. We'll be right back in a flash. We're talking allergies on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. Check out the DJ to Focus.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 4th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Are you one of the many folks who suffer from dry eye? Have you seen countless doctors and still can't find relief? Have they told you, sorry, but dry eye is something you'll have to live with or nothing can be done for you? Well, don't stand for that answer anymore just because someone else doesn't understand your dry eye problems. Go to the only eye doctor in Central Florida that specializes exclusively in dry eye and related diseases. Meet with Dr. Stephen Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where you'll be given up to 2 hours of face-to-face time with the doctor to get at the root cause of your dry eye pain and redness, plus begin targeted therapy right away. The Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, 3001 Swan Avenue in Tampa. Find them online at drmaskin.com. Haven't you waited long enough?
Here's your exclusive AccuWeather forecast.
Mostly sunny and less humid for today with a high of 78. A starlit sky for tonight. Lows will fall to near 58. And lots of sunshine again for tomorrow and a high of 77 degrees. Heading in towards Tuesday, turning colder and brisk with lots of sunshine. Look for a high temperature only of 69 degrees. That's your AccuWeather forecast. I'm meteorologist Justin Pavic.
Lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm Steve Maskin. We're talking allergies today with Dr. Dennis Ledford. Karen, if you're still there, I think you had one follow-up question.
Yes, Dr. Ledford, I have a daughter that is 2 years old who has actually a life-threatening allergy, a peanut tree nut allergy. She has an EpiPen for that. She also has outdoor allergens. My question is, what are the chances of my 6-year-old and my 2-year-old developing asthma later in life, as I'm an asthmatic and also an allergy sufferer, but I take shots for that? What are the chances of them developing asthma?
Good question.
Thanks for holding, Karen. I appreciate the opportunity to respond. It's, you have quite an allergic family, it sounds like. The peanut allergy, in contrast to the what I said about egg and milk, most children don't outgrow that. And so that the child who's had a reaction, a serious reaction to peanut or tree nuts, for the most part, we associate that with lifetime sensitivity. However, there are some, maybe up to 20%, maybe 30% of people who will outgrow peanut or tree nut allergy, but it's the exception, not the rule. Anyone with allergy to food, whether it's milk or peanut, is at higher risk of developing other allergic symptoms. Most commonly, allergic rhinitis, which is the symptoms of nasal congestion and sneezing and runny nose. But if you take people with rhinitis, they're more likely to develop asthma. So, again, I would estimate from your family history and the fact that you have other children with allergy, the chance of your child who's peanut allergic of becoming asthmatic is probably increased three to five-fold over the normal population, which means somewhere between 20 and 35% chance of asthma developing in that child, which means obviously there's still a good chance the child won't develop asthma.
Right. That's significant. Do you even recommend that at some point in time that two-year-old girl be retested because 20 or 30% do outgrow it, and because it's such, it does really impact the quality of life for not just that child but the whole family?
I think that is a policy we often do, is we repeat testing probably every 12 to 18 months, sometimes 24 months. And if the sensitivity declines, it's a good indication that the risk to the individual is declining. But the problem you run into is there's no assurance that if you ingest it, that that would not mean there would not be some symptoms. And that could almost make the allergy awaken and come back. And so most families still don't introduce the peanut or tree nut into their routine, but it is reassuring to them when their child becomes less sensitive that they're lower risk if they go to a birthday party and have a cookie that has a peanut in it. But I would never encourage them to say it's okay, have the peanut, unless they've had challenge, which shows no reaction. Again, usually under, especially with peanut, with medical supervision. Do not do that challenge at home.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Karen, any other follow-up question? Or?
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Good luck, Karen.
Thank you.
Beth, you are on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic with Steve Maskin. Do you have a question on allergy for Dr. Dennis Ledford?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon, Dr. Ledford. I'm calling from Tampa, and my question is, over the years, I'm 40 now, and our weather has changed. It doesn't get anywhere near as cold as it used to get, and it just seems like it's, like, hot all the time. Does that have any effect on the season of allergies?
Yes, Beth, there is an effect of environment on the type of allergens we're exposed to, and this is of growing interest because it's another way of assessing climate change is looking at an allergy.
Exactly.
But in Florida, of course, we've never had hard freezes at this area of Florida with any regularity. So allergy has always been, in some ways, a year-round problem in Florida. But with the shift of climate, whether it be decreased rain or less cold weather, that's going to affect the amount and type of allergens we're exposed to. Allergens, as a rule, come from living things, whether it be milk from a cow, or it be ragweed pollen from a plant, or it be an allergen from the skin or the saliva of a cat. They're pretty much all derived from living things. So anything that affects the environment could impact allergy. And so your point is well taken. Environment does influence the allergy and allergy symptoms.
So then when it's really dry and we haven't experienced rain for long periods of time, then is that why I experience suffering worse?
As a rule, rain helps reduce the levels of allergen in the air at that particular time. But, of course, the moisture in the soil is what allows life to produce more allergen. So rainy seasons and rainy weather often makes the trees healthier. So we'll have a higher pollen count in the following spring. But when you have rain and then it gets dry, you often get very high levels of things because that's when there's nothing to wash out the allergen. And this time of the year, it would typically be weed, pollen, and mold spores that often get quite high when we have dry weather, especially dry, windy days that blow these pollens and mold spores many miles. And so the exposure gets much higher when it's dry, such as we've had some weather like this since the rainy season's over.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Beth.
All right.
From Sarasota, we have Nancy on the line. Nancy, you're on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Do you have a question on allergy for Dr. Dennis Ledford?
Hi, Dr. Ledford, yes. I have seborrheic dermatitis, and I've had it for many, many years. My mother had it. My cousin had it. It seems to run in the family. And I've tried the Cold Tar product. I can't use any of those shampoos at all because I'm very, very allergic to many, many things, and they stopped testing me a long time ago and just said, well, you know, deal with it because you're okay, you're very healthy. And I am, but I'm wondering, is this connected to allergies, the seborrheic dermatitis in my scalp?
Yes, that's a great question because rashes are a part of allergy, but sometimes, of course, they can be a totally different problem. And seborrheic is not really an allergic problem. It may be due to an organism on the skin, but it's not really due to an allergic response to the organism. One product that could be tried, and perhaps you've already used this product, is something called ketoconazole, which is a shampoo.
Yes, I have. I've used that in the past and for many years, and that just stopped working.
Well, that's something that happens, too. And then salicylic acid. I mean, there's a variety of things that can be utilized, but it sounds like your skin is sensitive because you alluded to the fact that you're reactive to a lot of these products. And some of those reactions are not allergy. They're irritants that your skin is more sensitive to it. But in general, seborrhea is not an allergic response. Atopic dermatitis is an allergic reaction or rash. And contact dermatitis, which you can see with certain chemicals and poison ivy, is a type of allergy as well.
Okay, we are about ready to take a break. And Nancy, don't go away, because when we get back, I'm going to ask Dr. Ledford to respond as to the efficacy of tea tree shampoo in patients with seborrheic dermatitis. We're on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We'll be back in a flash.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 4th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 18 years and is board certified, fellowship trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and the American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2008 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please visit drmaskin.com. And if you've not found relief for your painful red, dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back. We're talking with Nancy from Sarasota about her seborrheic dermatitis. My guest today on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is Dr. Dennis Ledford, and we're talking allergies. Nancy, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. And Dr. Ledford did answer the question about the seborrheic dermatitis related to an allergic condition and something that I'm eating or ingesting. And he said, no, probably not. And then what about the tea tree shampoo?
Right. And the reason I bring that up is because I work with dry eye patients every day, and blepharitis is part and parcel of dry eye, where the sebaceous glands of the lid are frequently seen to be infested with mites, and tea tree shampoo is particularly effective at eradicating that infestation. So, Dr. Ledford, Dennis, what do you think about tea tree shampoo, your experience?
I've used it in rosacea, and again, blepharitis is part, and some people think those are two related conditions, which is different from seborrhea. But I think one of the problems we often run into is because I have allergy or because I have seborrhea doesn't mean I couldn't have something else too. So a lot of times these things are could be two or three conditions mixed together. And so it's hard to say with absolute certainty this will or will not work. And I think if it's a reasonably safe product that provides an option, it would be reasonable to try. In your case, Nancy, correct? Nancy?
Yes, correct.
It would be reasonable to try. Another thing I use for eczema, now again, seborrhea is not eczema, is oolong tea, which is a dark tea that has been shown in one study to help dermatitis, atopic dermatitis. Again, not seborrhea, but who's to say there may not be a couple of things going. And seborrhea and psoriasis and rosacea and dermatitis often get overlapped, and it's very confusing as to where one stops and the other one starts.
Excellent points. Nancy, okay. Do you have a follow-up? Or
I have one other question, and that is I've been using a fluocinonide topical solution, and it sort of controls it, but if I don't use it for 3 days in the different spots that I have in my scalp, they spread. Is that safe to use for any length of time?
It is a topical corticosteroid, fluocinonide, that you referred to, and has some mild negative effects, particularly thinning of the skin, but the scalp is resistant to that to a large degree, partly, of course, because your hair is covering your scalp and you wouldn't be able to see the thinning. But in general, we'd like to not to lean on topical corticosteroids, but they do work quite well for psoriasis and seborrhea. And so I think if that's the only thing and you've worked with your physician to look at other strategies, I would certainly continue to use that applied directly to the areas of most active involvement. There are some less potent topical steroids, but typically for scalp involvement, the fluocinonide is one that's often utilized.
And I would use the oolong tea topically as well?
No, I'm sorry. You drink that. It's a cup of oolong tea 3 times a day. But remember, I emphasize that was for eczema is where it's been studied. And that is not the same thing as seborrhea or psoriasis.
Oh.
It's a different condition. But, you know, as I said, sometimes these things are overlap. And if there hasn't been a solution, what's the harm in trying that? I mean, it's not expensive. It's not risky. You can get that at a health food store, a grocery store, oolong tea. It's just a dark tea. I mean, you have to be willing to drink some tea, but I don't think there would be any great harm in trying.
Two questions, Dennis, real quick. How do you spell oolong tea, and how quickly will you get a response if it's effective for you?
Ooh, without spell check, oolong. I think it's O-O-L-O-N-G.
O-O-N-G.
Yes, that's O-O-L-O-N-G, I think, oolong.
I do have some, and I drink tea just because I think it's healthy for me. I don't particularly like it, but a couple times a week I will drink it.
But I'm talking about 3 times a day a cup. So we're talking every meal you have oolong tea if you're going to use it. And I would say a trial, the study that was done that was published in the dermatology literature was a several-week trial, but you see improvement usually within 10 to 14 days in my experience and symptom reduction at the same time.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Nancy. Good luck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
On the line from Lutz is Kim. Kim, you're on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. We're talking allergies. Do you have a question for Dr. Ledford?
I do. I've been allergic to cats for as long as I can remember, and I developed asthma a little bit later in life with cats. I thought asthma tended to be something you grew out of as opposed to developed into.
Well, that is not absolutely true. It's common to see asthma in children that will improve as they get older. It's of interest that that occurs more in boys than girls, that if you look at asthma in childhood, more boys have asthma than girls. But if you look at asthma in adults, it's more common in women than men. So there's clearly differences that occur as we as our bodies change. And some asthma isn't allergic, but most the asthma we see in people under the age of 60 is going to be allergic. In your case, most likely it is due to the CAT sensitivity. But that can develop in adults, and even people over the age of 60 can develop new-onset asthma. And it's a serious issue, and I think if you do you have a CAT at home?
I don't, and I've noticed, though, that some it tends to be more it gets worse. I mean, I can go into somebody's house that has a CAT and within 5 minutes be able to tell that there's a CAT in the house, whether I've seen one or not. And then I've been around cats where it doesn't quite affect me as harshly, so I don't know if it's the type of cat. I mean, I always heard it was the saliva from the cat that you're actually allergic to. I don't know.
Yes, the cat allergen is very potent and stays around long after the animal's out of the room. And, in fact, Steve and I were talking before the show that studies have shown cat presence in a classroom or a department store or homes where there's never been a cat, probably carried by the people who have cats into that environment and left behind. And so there's exposure to cat even without the animal being in the house or in the building. But in general, the levels are much higher where the cat's present, and you're going to have higher levels of symptoms. But that's a very serious issue, and I would not take any consolation, and this cat doesn't seem to bother me, that it won't cause trouble. What happens sometimes is certain cats produce more allergen, so it's more evident to you. But if you stay there or you live with that or you develop a relationship with a cat and you bring it into your house, you're potentially looking at serious, potentially life-threatening problems. So, you know, be very, very careful with that. All cats produce the allergen, but but there is some variation amongst different individual cats as to how much they produce.
Okay. Now, what about, I mean, I know they've studied some forms of being hereditary. My father was asthmatic, and he kind of grew out of it. You know, here I am. I developed it later in life, and now my one of my daughters tends to do the same thing, and it seems to be put into cats mainly. I wasn't sure if it was a hereditary thing or just...
Yes. Allergies inherited and asthma is inherited. There may be separate genes, though. That's why some people can be allergic and not develop asthma, and some people can develop asthma and not always be allergic. But in your family, it does sound like it's both allergy and asthma, which is the most common scenario. But keep in mind what I said. Some people outgrow this as they get older, particularly boys. Women, though, who especially develop it in adulthood, don't tend out. That does not go away.
2 points.
Right.
2 points. First, Kim, did you say you do not have a cat in your home?
No, I've never actually. I think as a child we had a cat, but I as I got older and developed asthma, I have not been able to ever have a cat. I mean, I can, I can.
Do you?
If my children can touch cats and touch me, and I immediately break out.
Do you do things like take your shoes off at the door before you come back in your house and? And brush off your clothes and those things when you know you've been around a cat?
Yeah, and I try to stay away. I mean, I tend not to go into somebody's house if they have a cat just because I can immediately, I feel like my chest starts tightening and I start wheezing. So I try to get clear of that.
How old is your daughter?
The one with the asthma is 8, and she officially diagnosed her with asthma. She's just had several episodes where bronchitis has turned into a pneumonia, and she actually was staying at my mother-in-law's house when they inherited a cat from somebody, and it seemed like at that point is when it got worse.
Well, that's a good point. I think in your daughter's case, though, she may improve as she gets older. I'm not saying she won't outgrow it just because she's a girl, not a boy. I'm just saying adult onset asthma you don't tend to outgrow, but she still might get better as she gets older. And many times it's the combination of a cold and the presence of the allergen is really the whammy that sets off the symptoms. So, again, be very careful with her being around animals and going to visit her grandmother if there's a cat in the house.
Dennis,
we did get rid of it.
Good.
With adult onset asthma in the female, is there a relationship with the menopause?
That's a great question because it seems to intensify around menopause, and so that there's a beginning of this premenopausal. But it's around menopause that things seem to get a lot more difficult to treat. So it seems prior to menopause, it begins to develop and then intensifies around menopause. And then if you look at adult onset after menopause, men and women are equal, which suggests that there's a hormonal effect that increases your risk of asthma. So that women who are menstruating are at risk of developing asthma, which often kind of gets really bad around menopause, but usually they don't get rid of it even after menopause.
Okay.
Well, then let me ask you, if you don't mind, ask you this. When I was pregnant with my first daughter and was around a cat, I don't think I've ever experienced it as bad as I did when I was pregnant. Like that seemed, for something about me being pregnant at that time, I guess you're saying the hormones, like you just said, seemed to trigger it way worse than any other time.
Well, I wouldn't say in the general terms that hormones make asthma always worse, but certainly we know with women who are menstruating, they seem to be at greater risk of developing asthma than men who are sexually mature. So there seems to be something about female hormones. But sometimes in pregnancy, asthma gets better. So it isn't just a universal that everyone who's female who's got hormones is going to have worse symptoms. It's just in generalization, I was trying to make the point that there could be a hormonal effect.
Okay. Kim, thanks so much for your questions. We'll be right back with more allergies on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Back in a flash.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 4th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm Steve Maskin. We've been talking allergies for the past 55 minutes with Dr. Dennis Ledford. And Dennis, during the last few minutes, I'd like to talk to you about anaphylaxis, which of course is a life-threatening allergic reaction. Would you further define anaphylaxis, and particularly for the listeners out there, when should they carry an EpiPen? What other information should they know about dealing with potential life-threatening allergies?
Well, anaphylaxis is, as you defined it, it's a life-threatening immune response, and it tends to be very acute and rapid onset. And the example that's probably best known to the listening audience would be Beth. I'm not certain which person had the child who had peanut allergy, but that would be probably the most common cause of food allergy that causes anaphylaxis. But other foods that are likely to cause anaphylaxis are tree nuts. Remember, peanuts are not really tree nuts. One grows in the ground, one hangs on trees. Fish and shellfish. It may be seeds like poppy seeds and sesame seeds. These are the foods that make up most all the anaphylactic events. But you can also have anaphylaxis to insects, stings, as well as medications. So there's a variety of potential allergens that can cause anaphylaxis. If you've had life-threatening anaphylaxis, you should have epinephrine. That is the treatment. Antihistamines help the itch of anaphylaxis, but do not save your life. So if you've had true anaphylaxis, then you should have epinephrine. The reason I say true anaphylaxis is sometimes it is not clear if it was really anaphylaxis. Urticaria can occur, for example, an itchy skin rash, without anaphylaxis. But if you feel funny and you have urticaria, could that have been anaphylaxis? And that's where sometimes it's quite confusing. So, again, you need to be evaluated by someone who's comfortable in making this diagnosis, be appropriately tested to verify sensitivity to the allergen likely to have caused it, and in that context, you should carry an epinephrine as that's life-saving.
Okay, so let's say I'm an 18-year-old woman, and one Sunday morning I had a poppy seed bagel with cream cheese on it, and I start having some shortness of breath. What should I do at that point?
With shortness of breath as the only symptom, it still may not be anaphylaxis, but with that acute onset, no past history, I would say that it is likely that you were having a reaction to the poppy seed. It doesn't have to have been the poppy seed. It could have been something else. Sometimes we eat things that have multiple ingredients. In fact, most of the time that's the case. And so it can be quite confusing to pin down what caused the reaction. And unfortunately, sometimes we go through a lot of tests and don't find the cause, and you're left with this sort of cloud hanging over you. Nobody knows what caused my reaction, but I think it was anaphylaxis. In that case, it's a bit more challenging, but I would still recommend epinephrine, at least for the short term, until we see if this happens again. But we have a test that we could do for poppy seed that would verify whether you're allergic. And if you were, then I would definitely then say you should avoid poppy seed, but carry the epinephrine, because sometimes people put things in foods and don't tell you, and you don't always know.
All right, great point. So that patient then should be evaluated to see if they have a sensitivity, potential anaphylaxis, and if so, then they should carry an EpiPen with them.
Right. I would recommend they be seen by an allergy specialist who would know what the appropriate test to do to verify the sensitivity.
Excellent. Okay, well, that wraps up our hour on allergies. I'd like to thank Dr. Dennis Ledford for being here with sharing his expertise on allergies. This is the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We'll see you next week. Where we'll be discussing bladder incontinence with Dr. Lennox Hoyt. Have a great week.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Steve Maskin.
Focus on fear.